Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is Tom Clark. Tom, how are you doing on this Thursday afternoon?
To be honest, Nat, I'm not great.
Why?
I've only just about recovered from the merciless kicking that I took on Monday's show. I've always considered Gregor to be, you know, a fair, upstanding bloke, but absolutely tore me to shreds on Monday's show and failed to mention that I correctly predicted that Sevilla would beat Man United and just tore me apart on all my other points.
I mean, well,
I've read a lot about his playing days and I've heard a lot about his career, and I never knew him to be one who liked an off-the-ball tackle, but apparently I was wrong.
Oh, Gregor, would you like a reply right now?
No, I'm happy to take that. I don't mind a two-footed tackle every now and then.
Oh, he plays dirty, does our Gregor, every now and then.
I consider myself, you know, cleansed a little bit. I feel happier now, so it's fine. We can proceed as friends again.
But I suppose I should ask you, because obviously you're referring to the previous podcast last week where you were on with us, and you talked about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer perhaps not being the right man to lead Manchester United. They had the semi-final heartbreak against Sevilla, as you pointed out, in the Europa League on Sunday. So do you sort of feel a bit vindicated by all of it?
Just a tad, but I'm not the sort to bring it up again and again and again. I the next time I'm on with Johnny Northcroft, I won't be mentioning it. And, you know, I won't be the first person when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer gets sacked halfway through next season to say, I told you so. So, I mean, you know, I'll be the bigger man on this occasion for the rest of the show.
Lovely.
Said a bit now.
Lovely. You won't play dirty like Gregor. Just checking in with you, Gregor. How are you?
I'm good, yes. I can't believe fixtures released today, and it just feels like one season blends into the next. It's just a kind of constant, never-ending feast of football, which I both love and am slightly sort of overwhelmed by at this stage.
I know, you're absolutely right. But yeah, it's come around quick, this new season. I can't believe in just a couple of weeks we'll be talking about the 2020-2021 season and with all of that to come. But that's for later. Coming up, we're looking ahead to Sunday's Champions League final and talking football giant killings. But we start in North London.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tottenham have completed the signing of goalkeeper Joe Hart on a contract until 2022. Hart successfully underwent a medical this week and will compete with Paolo Gazzaniga for Hugo Lloris's number one spot in Jose Mourinho's squad next season. The 33-year-old became a free agent after his contract came to an end at Burnley at the end of last season, in a campaign where he made just three appearances in all competitions in 2019-20. Part of the reason behind the signing is for Mourinho to increase his squad's homegrown quota. Premier League rules stipulate clubs must name no more than 17 overseas players in their squads of 25, and Mourinho was limited to naming just 21 players in his league squad in February, with only four English-bred stars on board. So, Tom, for you, Joe Hart to Tottenham, is that a good move?
I think so, yes. It depends entirely on how we look at Joe Hart and on what we consider to be a good goalkeeping signing. If we're saying, is signing someone with all his experience and Premier League quality a good signing as a number two, or even, dare I say, a number three goalkeeper, a good deal, particularly as we consider that he reports suggests he's taken a £15,000 a week pay cut from what he was on at Burnley previously. I would say it is a very good signing. But the difficulty is with Joe Hart is that he's one of these players that, and we've seen it with the reaction to the signing, he garners so much interest. And it's this kind of, it's almost a curse of being a one-time England number one. particularly in the time after David Seaman, who obviously had the jersey for so long. Hart had that kind of meteoric rise, so to speak, from that great season at Birmingham, where he's on loan, then got put into the Manchester City team, then he was in the, you know, he was in the England squad, and all of a sudden he was England number one. And I think at no point have we ever really assessed, I don't really feel like anyone's ever assessed whether Joe Hart is a world-class goalkeeper, a very good goalkeeper. You just judge him on where he played. So then when he was at Manchester City, everyone just assumes, oh, he's won titles, he's a world-class goalkeeper. I don't really feel, ever feel Joe Hart has been a world-class goalkeeper. I think he's been a very good goalkeeper who has had a very good career. And from that point of view, it's a good signing for Tottenham to bring in someone of his experience. But I can see why people are quick to jump on the idea that Joe Hart has fallen from grace or things like that, because of where he was and all the difficulties he's had in the last few seasons.
I mean, there have been some people, Gregor, that are sort of bemused by this move for Joe Hart. Do you think he should be applauded for joining a top Premier League team? Or does it actually surprise you that he's gone to a team where he isn't guaranteed that number one jersey?
I think it's always very difficult for a player who's suffered this kind of fall from grace, and that it was looking very unlikely, or actually clearly impossible, that he was going to get a Premier League team who were willing to sign him as their number one. So at that point, you're looking below that, or you're looking abroad again, and you're looking at a kind of a fair old drop in status and probably earnings as well. So it's very difficult for him, you know, to sign for a club in the Championship, let's say, or, you know, try and venture abroad again. You're kind of out of sight and out of mind a little bit. And as Tom said, there would then again be this kind of sideshow of Joe Hart playing in some kind of obscure league or out with the Premier League. So, I mean, for him, it's a good move. And I think actually for Spurs, it is pretty good too. You're getting someone who of great experience, who's still a capable goalkeeper. He's had he's had really tough time, basically since 2016. But you're getting him on a free and on fairly kind of middling earnings for a Premier League player these days. So I think for both sides, it's kind of a convenient and sensible move, really.
Well, Tottenham have certainly bought a proven Premier League stopper. Hart has won the Premier League twice, the League Cup twice, and won FA Cup during his time at Manchester City, and has 75 England caps. However, the 2015-16 season would see Hart's status fall from the heights of 10 saves in a defeat to Barcelona in the Champions League, which saw him singled out for praise by none other than Lionel Messi, to the lows of England's Euro 2016 defeat to Iceland, which saw Hart come in for criticism for his performances in the tournament. 2016 was also the year that Pep Guardiola joined Manchester City, and with one of his first decisions, took Hart out of the starting lineup, with Guardiola unimpressed by Hart's ability with the ball at his feet. Tom, why do you think he's never really recovered from that, I suppose we could now refer to it as a difficult 2016?
Yeah, definitely. It's very difficult. And I would say that for me, being a goalkeeper in modern football is the most difficult position in terms of, you know, we talk a lot about narrative around both a team, a coach, a player. I think being a goalkeeper in the spotlight of today with social media, with as soon as something happens on the pitch, on TV, there's a GIF going round, you know, people are sharing it. And what have you seen this cock up? I think being a goalkeeper is the toughest thing, because you only need to make one mistake, or you only need to have one thing attached to your name, and that can basically destroy your career. And Joe Hart was very quickly the guy who was ditched by Pep Guardiola. And it comes back to that point before I was talking about, you have, at that point, the most highly regarded coach in the world taking over Manchester City and saying, this guy is not good enough for me. Now, obviously, people decided to then take that and say that was a huge slight on Joe Hart as a goalkeeper in general. I don't think it was. I think it was just Guardiola saying, you're not right for me. But that doesn't make Joe Hart suddenly a 5 out of 10 goalkeeper. It doesn't make him middle of the road. He's still a very good goalkeeper. He's just not what Pep Guardiola wanted and needed. And he's been proved right, because you would say, looking at Manchester City team, you'd have Edison over Joe Hart all day, every day of the week. So I think that to me, he gets my sympathy for that, because, and the same with the England one as well. Yes, the goal he conceded in the Iceland game wasn't the best. You know, he got a very weak hand to a shot that he probably should have saved. But let's be honest, it comes back to that point again. You've got the rest of his teammates. Joe Hart should probably have been able to let two through his legs against Iceland, and his teammates should have been able to bail him out. But we all remember that game. England barely managed a shot on goal, apart from the one they scored very early on, and they looked completely clueless. So again, the spotlight then goes on, oh, Joe Hart, what a cock-up, what a nightmare, when actually there's far more factors at play, but the goalkeeper gets singled out every time. And I think in those two instances, they're very different, but they're two things that it's very harsh on him that became attached to his name and to his career.
Well, I mean, that is the problem, isn't it, at the end of the day, Gregor, as Tom has alluded to. You know, if a striker makes a mistake, he's got 10 other teammates to help him out. If a defender similarly makes a mistake, you've got the goalkeeper there to spare some blushes. But a goalkeeper is that last line of defence. And when they may make a mistake, it is highlighted so much more than anybody else.
Yeah, but that's the job of the goalkeeper, I'm afraid, and that's why they're often a bit crazy to do it, in my view.
Never thought about being one.
Actually, having said that, I was a goalkeeper as a really young kid, and then I changed school, and the school's team's manager was the goalkeeper's dad, so I thought, I'm not going to get a game, and I went out field, and the rest is history. Anyway, I've got a little aside there. I think, Hart... I find his temperament is fascinating, in that when he was young, you know, he seems like the confident, cocky, very talented, and he's, you know, there's no doubt, and as Tom said, he's definitely not in the same category as some of the world's leading goalkeepers, but he was outstanding for Manchester City for a long time, and then it seemed that as he kind of got older, the perception of that, at least, changed to becoming kind of, I don't know, like panicky almost. And there was, you know, I remember seeing sort of images of him in the tunnel before those England games in the World Cup, and he looked like he was about to have a panic attack. So, you know, they're saying the psychology of Joe Hart has been quite interesting, the way it's changed, I think. And I don't think you can blame, you know, Guardiola alone for this. I think his form was dropping before Guardiola came, and Guardiola saw a specific weakness in his game that he saw was not compatible with the way he plays football. And then from then, it's just been, you know, I think it's probably a cumulative effect. He's left the club that he was held in such high regard at, and the moves he's had have not worked out one after another, and from there, it's a kind of a slope for him, and I think he really has struggled with it. So, you know, I would hope he gets an opportunity to play some football, and he can kind of return to some of his best form, because you know, he has been, there's no doubt, he has been a great goalkeeper for Manchester City and for England for a number of years.
Considering his temperament then, Tom, is this a far stretch perhaps to suggest that Pep Guardiola may have played a part in ruining his career?
I think inadvertently, but for once I'm not going to blame Pep Guardiola for something on the Game Podcast, which is rare for me, I know. I just think that was a clinical decision by a manager who wanted the best from his team. I'm interested in Gregor's take on the mentality side of it and how you approach it as a player, because if we go back to that moment when Guardiola says, you're not for me, and even I can remember, all of us, you know, I was a journalist at the time, and I was quite surprised. I thought, well, at least he's got his goalkeeper position sorted. And then he says, no, I want a new number one. And not only do I want a new number one, you're probably not going to get any games, mate, sorry. As a goalkeeper, that then puts you in an incredibly difficult position. Because, let's say, you're a right-back, you know, who's maybe coming towards the end of his career. You can move to another club. You're probably you might come off the bench in the odd game. You might play in a system that's a little bit different. For a goalkeeper, it's you're either in or you're out. And because of the idea that we like consistency with our goalkeepers, and, you know, again, I'll refer to Gregor on this, who was a defender, you want a reliability so teams don't chop and change as much. That must be so hard as a player, to have gone from being number one to then having to go, do I go to Torino for a year? Do I go to West Ham for a bit? You know, I just want to know how, as a player, you know, Gregor's obviously moved around and played for different teams. That must be so difficult to try and work out what my next move is based on how am I going to get a game.
Look, I mean, it might be a cliche, but I think football, it's always about how you respond from setbacks, whether that's a bad game or whether it's somebody's opinion. And I think probably Hart really didn't have any serious setbacks to respond to until that point. You know, he was on a, as I say, I think his statistics show that he was on a, his form was dipping in the seasons leading up to Guardiola's arrival. But that was a huge, you know, that's a huge blow, and it's a very public one, and it's a kind of, I've never had to suffer quite as public a kind of, I suppose your manager, it's calling you out and saying you're not good enough, and the way he responded, he had the opportunities. That's the thing. He had the opportunity at Torino. He had it at West Ham, and he didn't do so. I think, you know, his form, he made errors in both of those moves, and I think people at those clubs also kind of probably didn't think that he'd done particularly well in those moves. So it's very hard to respond for. But that's, as I say, it's, I think the kind of psychology of Joe Hart's career in the last 5 or 6 years has been pretty fascinating, because he was this kind of young buck that was, you know, he seemed very confident and always had a smile on his face. He's a bit like Dean Henderson now. You know, you look at him in the field of play and you think he's very confident in his ability and has a bit of swagger, and that's what you like to see the young goalkeeper. But then that changed dramatically, and now you look at him and you think that he's got some kind of demons in his mind, and I hope he can get past that now.
I suppose the final question on this, when we talk about Joe Hart's move to Tottenham, Tom, is, do you think he really can dislodge Hugo Lloris and become Tottenham's new number one?
I think it's unlikely. I think he could, because I think, again, and this is slightly harsh on Joe Hart with the narrative of, oh, he's gone in as the homegrown quota. I mean, that is understandably and clearly is part of the reason for the deal. But then if you look at some of those other goalkeepers, English goalkeepers down the years, you know, Richard Wright was at Manchester City for years, never played a game, was just in there as the third choice goalkeeper. You know, we all kind of laughed when Lee Grant left Stoke to go to Manchester United, but we all knew why. Rob Green went to Chelsea. Scott Carson is now at Manchester City, I think. Joe Hart is not those, the same as those players. He will be fiercely competitive and wanting to prove a point. And in a way, I kind of hope he does. I hope he at least gets some game time, maybe in the cup competitions, and reminds us all again of what a great goalkeeper he is. Because in, you know, his time at West Ham, they were obviously fighting up against relegation. Tough decisions had to be made. Again, I go back to that thing. He made one mistake, maybe let one goal in at his near post, and people start going, out of the team. So I would really hope that he gets a chance to remind us again what a good goalkeeper he was for all those years. But I'd be very surprised if he replaces Hugo Lloris, I've got to say.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and Off Air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Now, on Sunday, Paris Saint-Germain will take on Bayern Munich at the Estadio de Luz in Lisbon in this season's Champions League final. A first-half double from Serge Gnabry helped put Bayern Munich into their first Champions League final since 2013 with a 3-0 win over Lyon, whilst PSG are through to their first ever Champions League final, courtesy of a deserved victory over RB Leipzig. Gregor, are these the two best teams in the final this year, do you think?
One of them definitely is Bayern. PSG, I'm slightly sceptical about still. Look, I mean, there's no doubt that PSG this year look more of a team. And that is the thing. There's been so much money spent. They've signed so many kind of star players. But they've had a kind of a bit of a weak backbone, and they've not really looked like a collective until this season. And I mean, you have to say, if you look back at their form in the Champions League, they scored 7 goals against Real Madrid over 2 games. They showed real balls to come back against Dortmund after losing the first leg. I think that was in the last 16 game. You know, again, against Atalanta, late comeback. That was real, you know, showed real character in that. And a very convincing win against Leipzig. So they certainly deserve to be in the final this year. And they have a front three that is really as good as probably anything in Europe. Liverpool mm-hmm. might have something to say about that, but it's very close. And Bayern, you know, I think Bayern are outstanding. They undoubtedly deserve to be in the final. So Bayern, yes. PSG, they deserve to be in the final. But I would, you know, I think the one thing you'd say if you're looking around at who's better than them this year, it's not easy because there's a lot of teams in turmoil. Real Madrid aren't what they were. Barca are a shambles. Juventus haven't showed the kind of, or Manchester City haven't shown the kind of character needed to get to the latter stages. Liverpool perhaps, but you know they fell away. So they deserve to be in the final, and it's got the makings of a very kind of high scoring final. So probably be 0-0.
Great, we look forward to that. But Tom, is PSG against Bayern mouth-watering for you?
I think I would have liked to have seen Liverpool against Bayern Munich. I think that would have been probably the ideal final. I think Bayern Munich are by far and away the strongest team in every sense, both going forward and defensively. The strength and depth of the squad is something that I think you look at with these two teams and say that for all that PSG have got Mbappe and Neymar, when you look at the benches, Bayern Munich's is far stronger. But I think it could be a good game, and I think it'll be really interesting. And they are obviously two teams that, in terms of our general knowledge of them, we know far more as general football fans about the likes of Juventus and Barcelona and Real Madrid. And these are two teams that, you know, will probably teach us a thing or two about the kind of players and their style of play. So from that point of view, if you're one of the football geeks out there like me, who probably I wouldn't mind if it was 0-0. I wouldn't mind it if PSG could do a bit of a job on Bayern and we saw a bit of a tense 0-0 and a bit of a tactical back and forth. So I'm really excited about it, and I think it'll be a really, really entertaining game, even if it is 0-0.
So who do we make favourites for Sunday's final, Gregor? I'm guessing, but by the way you were talking, you're opting for Bayern Munich.
Yeah, I mean, look, Bayern have got some questions at the back in terms of, you know, they play such a high line, and if Alphonso Davies, you know, gives himself too much of too much ground to make up when he chases back, and he can make up ground than most people, but you know, they're dependent on, you know, because they play such a high line, they are dependent on the pace of Davies and one or two other defenders to kind of to make some pretty long recovery runs. So I think Bayern, though, the amount of goals they've scored, they've scored 7 against Spurs, 3 and 4 against Chelsea, 8 against Barca. I think in every Champions League game they've scored 3 or more, apart from a 2-0 win against Olympiakos. Lewandowski, I think
you'll find that's Lewandowski. Yeah, Thomas Muller
nice
said.
Nice one. I mean, look, and Gnabry as well. I think, you know, Lyon started really well in that game the other night, and they had a number of chances to score, which again showed that Bayern did have, you know, do have these weaknesses, or there will be opportunities. PSG will have opportunities, and it's about taking them, because the teams that Bayern have faced haven't always done so in the Champions League. But we know that Bayern will score, and they're so clinical. Like, just went up the other end, and Gnabry cutting off the line, smashed one in the top corner, and the trajectory of the game after that was just, you know, completely altered. So yes, I think Bayern will outscore PSG. So I make Bayern favourites.
So it's Bayern for you. I know, Tom, you're hoping for a tactical 0-0 masterclass. Who would you be edging towards if you had to pick someone you think should and could win this?
I think the obvious money is on Bayern Munich. I think PSG will give them the toughest test that they've had in terms of the tactical battle. But also, alluding to going back to something Gregor said before about them, PSG being more of a team and more of a collective, and cohesive outfit on the pitch, they're far more difficult to break down. I think in the previous seasons, you know, and under previous regimes, they've had this kind of attitude of let's just spend lots of money and put star players on the pitch and, you know, we'll see it work. I think this is the first season that, as well as having the pure class of Di Maria, Neymar and Mbappe, you've actually got some steel behind them. The defence is pretty solid and they've got some talent at fullback as well. They've brought people like Ander Herrera to, you know, run around, the king of just running around and kicking people in midfield, which is no bad thing, even at the highest level. And I would just say, as speaking as someone, you know, who's had his reputation ripped to shreds on the game podcast, a little shout out for Jose Mourinho when it comes to the Bayern Munich team. Ivan Perisic and Jerome Boateng, both in their starting lineups in the semi-final, both were people that Jose Mourinho wanted to sign, of course, for Manchester United when he was there to consider that they would have made them stronger. Bayern are a very, very strong team in every single position, and I think you'd have to make them favourites, but I wouldn't be surprised if PSG pushed them a lot closer than Barcelona did, that's for sure.
Tom, you did say you weren't going to bring that up anymore about being ripped apart.
I'm going to be the bigger man, he said.
I just wanted to defend Jose Mourinho, and I just...
All right.
Anyway, moving on.
All right, we'll let you off this one time.
Thanks.
But of course, focusing back onto the Champions League final, a victory in the final would complete PSG's meteoric rise, helped largely by their 2011 takeover by Tamim bin Hamid Al Thani, the ruler of Qatar, who owns the club through state-owned shareholding organisation Qatar Sports Investments, QSI. Now, the takeover instantly made them one of the richest clubs in the world, and since then, spending on transfers has passed the £1 billion mark. Many were quick to point out that PSG's starting lineup in their semi-final versus Leipzig cost a whopping £540 million compared to Bayern's £90 million starting 11 versus Lyon. Gregor, can we still enjoy PSG's success knowing it's all down to financial investment?
I can enjoy their football. I can enjoy watching Neymar and Mbappe kind of link up so beautifully and some of the skills and the quality on show, but their success, I wouldn't say I'd enjoy it. It's a sports washing project. It seems ridiculous the amount of time I've had to spend speaking about this in the podcast this year. It's what Newcastle came very close to being. It's really, although Manchester City fans will probably not like me saying it, it's what Manchester City are. It's very questionable nation states, essentially, buying football clubs to improve their image on the kind of global stage. I would enjoy their success. And, you know, actually, it's funny because, it's not funny, but it's kind of almost counterproductive at moments like this, because their place in the final will actually make the kind of the spotlight fall on some of their human rights issues and, you know, why they still can't answer how many migrant workers have died since 2012 and constructing the stadiums for the World Cup. So, you know, the purpose will be, well, this is what they've aimed for all the time. They want to become champions of Europe. So that, in one sense, they're very close to that. In another sense, I'm sure there will be, in the coming days, there will be a spotlight falling upon some of the darkness kind of behind this whole project.
Of course, Tom, I know that Manchester City obviously have had their, how should I put it? I don't want to say enemies, but those that don't wish them success because of their newfound wealth. When you think about PSG, is some of the sour grapes that are extended towards them because of the fact that people think they have bought their trophies?
I think you've got to split this question off into almost two different parts, I guess. Because if you're talking about sour grapes in terms of their footballing success, in terms of spending a lot of money in order to be successful, I think it's very easy to pocket off the PSGs and the Manchester Cities, clubs who have had such an extreme uplift in wealth in such a short space of time, and say, oh, they've only bought their success. I mean, that's always been the way in football ever since, you know, the Premier League came in. Blackburn Rovers bought Alan Shearer, and then they won the league. Alex Ferguson did it every single season, including in his last one. He went to Arsenal and paid £20 million for Robin van Persie, who was 29, essentially for one season to finish Premier League top goalscorer. I know it's not on the same level as PSG, but
you've got to look at their purpose for the spending as well.
Absolutely, that's the second point I was going to come to. If you're broadening it out and saying what is the purpose for it, and looking at the very dark and very dangerous and very scary side of the PSG investment, then it's not sour grapes, but it is well worth highlighting and bringing into the conversation. But I think it's slightly unfair to tar the players and the on pitch success. You know, some of these players are going to win if they happen to pull off a bit of a shock and beat Bayern Munich. You know, they've won the Champions League, and there's lots of questionable decisions that go on in football, and there's lots and lots of powerful people who are linked to top level football clubs who, it's kind of a piece of string. Once you start pulling at it, you could get a long way down the list in terms of teams. PSG, you know, are the worst in lots of respects, but I think it would be slightly harsh to lump it all into one conversation, if you like, and say, oh, it's horrible, terrible for the game that they've won.
Yeah, also, as you pointed out, the cost of their squad dwarfs that of Bayern Munich's, but there's Tuchel would deserve a huge amount of credit if PSG were to win, because to be able to kind of, as I say, to form a team out of what was a group of individuals and to harness kind of and engage so many egos like that, there's no mean feat. That's no mean feat at all. So, I don't think you can't take away from the achievement that would have been for these individuals. But the kind of bigger picture is still something that, as you say, needs to be highlighted.
The bigger picture is very, very murky, undoubtedly. But, if you then think about Bayern, it's obviously not on the same, sport-washing level that we're talking about with the links to PSG. But, they've essentially been bullying the German league for years. I mean, any top player anywhere near the highest level in Germany, you can put a decent bit of money on that he's going to end up at Bayern Munich. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, Robert Lewandowski, who himself had two great seasons at Borussia Dortmund, was coming to the end of his contract. Oh, look at that. He's ended up at Bayern Munich on a free. Leon Goretzka, who's currently playing in their midfield, came from Schalke, was one of the hottest young talents in Europe in midfield. Oh, look at that. He signed a pre-contract agreement with Bayern Munich. I wouldn't even be half surprised. Erling Haaland, we're so excited about him. Everyone talking about whether he's going to go to Barcelona or Manchester United. Lewandowski's 33 in 2 years' time. Who are they going to be looking at to replace him? It's obviously, I am not comparing Bayern Munich's financial muscle in the Bundesliga to, some of the things we're talking about in PSG. But I think it's a bit naive to just go Manchester City and PSG are horrendous people and everything behind them is, and Bayern Munich and Manchester United are completely pure and innocent and all their successes, nothing bad comes from their success and dominance over the last few years. So I think just a little broader balance, I think, is needed in the debate.
Well, what we do know for certain is that there will be no English or Spanish representative in the Champions League final for the first time since 2013, with neither country even making the semi-finals this season. So do we think there might be a shift in the balance of power in Europe, Gregor?
Yeah, I think, I don't think it's a shift towards France. I think it's a shift slightly away from Spain and towards Germany. There's three of the four head coaches in the semi-finals were German, and it'll be contested between the two Germans in the final. So I think the shift in power, or the kind of the competing powers now in European football, are between the Spanish kind of Guardiolista, I think sometimes people call it, sort of style of play, and the German, Jurgen Klopp is the sort of leading at the forefront of that. And I think, much of that is to do with pressing. I think the two philosophies are, both are dominating possession, but it's out of possession. It's who can organise and energise the press the best and sustain it. And I think Germany, the kind of German philosophy, is in the lead in that just now. It's by no means a done thing, I think. Both both are dealing with kind of the best players in the world, and it's how they employ them. I think the kind of shift is towards Germany, but I don't think it's a done thing now. I think you know, the Spanish style of play is still hugely successful and probably will be in the future.
So you heard him there, Tom. Gregor alluding to the fact that it might not be shifting towards France, but maybe more towards Germany. When you think about PSG and Bayern, do you think these are two sides, though, that will be very much here to stay and here to stay at the very top?
I think with both sides, what's interesting about this final is that, as Gregor alluded to before with PSG, but this has been the competition they've both been obsessed with for so many seasons. Partly because, you know, within the domestic side of things, they just dominate their leagues. You know, it's not really this kind of Premier League style where six teams are in it up until March. You know, in the Bundesliga and in Liga, you know, it's pretty much these two pull away quite early and are going to dominate. That might change over the next coming seasons with Borussia Dortmund and things like that. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that these two teams have been obsessed with this competition for so long, and they'll be absolutely delighted to be in the final now. I would agree with Gregor that PSG sustainability I'd be unsure about. And what I find fascinating about Germany, and again, it's something we've talked about on the podcast before, it's the overall club ethos and model, not just on the pitch, but off the pitch. If you look at where either both the young players and young talented players from around the world, we've seen it with Jude Bellingham, Jadon Sancho, where are they going to play? Germany. And we also look at players like Philippe Coutinho, struggling for a bit of form. You know, who picks them up? I talked about before, even Perisic, he's on loan from Inter Milan to Bayern Munich. They've got another couple of top stars on loan. They get the best out of them. Jerome Boateng, their centre-back, had a season at Manchester City, widely considered not up to it, has since been a mainstay in the defence for Bayern Munich. So the overall recruitment and thinking and planning and building of a club and a structure that we saw, as Gregor said, in Spain with Barcelona, with La Masia, with, you know, keep the ball, pass the ball, that was, you know, 10 years ago. And now we're seeing the German model take over, which Klopp has implemented at Liverpool. So I think it's again comes back to, and we've obviously talked a lot about Barcelona. They are now finding that you can't just buy players to fix things. And even if you've got Lionel Messi, that's not enough anymore. You have to have the overall club ethos and structure in place in order to have success on the pitch.
Gregor, do you agree? Do you think that the German model is the way forward, and that many should be looking at how successful it has been?
Well, as I say, I think really it's quite specific as well. I think, you know, Guardiola and Klopp are the two kind of leading, they're the leading figures of both of these styles of play, really, and both have kind of very detailed constructs of attacking football. You know, there are differences. Obviously, Liverpool are slightly more dynamic and kind of they get the ball from back to front quicker often. But the biggest difference between them is what they do without the ball, and the way they press, and the way that they handle transitions of play. So if they lose the ball, Manchester City's biggest weakness is a ball over the top that kind of beats their press, and they don't have players at the moment who are good enough, maybe as good as a Van Dijk or a player like that to deal with the transition like that. So I think, you know, it's not just about individual players as well. I think that Germany is the German kind of philosophy. It's slightly speaking in slightly broad terms here. The way they press is the best in the world, and pressing has become one of the most important kind of dynamics in modern football.
Now, we finished this week with a look at a brilliant piece written for The Times by Molly Hudson. From a teenage dream to battling the biggest clubs in Europe, the rise of Glasgow City. Only formed in 1998, they now meet Wolfsburg in the Champions League quarterfinals, thanks largely to Laura Montgomery, who's 44, their former player and now general manager. It is quite the achievement. Glasgow will play their quarterfinal in the Anoeta Stadium in San Sebastian with a capacity of over 39,000. Their usual home is Petershill Park, an AstroTurf with a capacity of 1,000, which has 500 seats, while Wolfsburg play at the AOK Stadion with a capacity of just over 5,000. The difference between the champions of Scotland and some of Europe's superpowers is stark. The likes of Lyon and Wolfsburg are able to offer 5- and 6-figure deals for many of their players. For Glasgow, every member of the team relies on a day job or university to fit around their training schedule. Gregor, this is quite remarkable. It is incredible that Glasgow City have made the Champions League quarterfinals, isn't it?
Amazing story. Really is amazing. It's just in the kind of, in modern football, this kind of thing doesn't happen at all anymore. And it's a story that I didn't know a great deal about and read it. It's a brilliant piece by Molly. I would advise anyone to go and read it if they haven't already. And the kind of thing it makes you realise is that there's still kind of huge, great power in just the will of people to kind of to build something at a level like this. And it kind of, there's probably some comparisons to Doncaster Bells down south in England. You know, they've dominated women's football for a long time, and the kind of the way that that the women's game has grown and developed and there's been more and more money put into it, they've kind of, their standing has fallen away a bit. And that's not really happened in Scotland yet. So, you know, Glasgow City are still at the forefront of Scottish football. And, you know, it's not good that there's not been the same level of investment in women's football in Scotland. And I think, you know, probably that's beginning to change, but it's a remarkable story. And for these girls that are, you know, all, you know, part-time and training in the evenings, to be coming up against people who are professional and earning, you know, big money and playing for big clubs of huge stature, it would be a fairy tale if they were to progress any further.
Oh, it certainly would be that. But Tom, the story of Glasgow City is perhaps only familiar to those within the women's game. I know that we all talked about it before we came together on this podcast, and a few of us were like, oh, I hadn't really heard of Glasgow City. When you think about the women's game, do you think that the men's side of things could do more in Scotland to promote women's football?
Absolutely. I think it's almost, the more I've, you know, been fascinated by this story, the first time I discussed it with Molly, the more I've kind of realised how sad it is, almost, as great a story as it is, and, you know, the efforts of Laura Montgomery and all the other people. When you read the story, you know, she was 18 and struggling with a bad knee injury, and she just decided there's not enough opportunity here. I'm going to do something about it. When you think about it from the flip side, it's almost sad that that had to happen. That, you know, you have Celtic and Rangers are two names that resonate throughout world football, never mind in the UK. And the fact that only now in the last few seasons are they doing anything about promoting the women's game, offering better funding to their teams. It's almost a shame, because what I fear might happen now is that Glasgow City will almost be overtaken and, you know, maybe consumed by these two great names that are in the same country. So I think there's a lot to be done. And let's be honest, there's a lot to be done, not just in Scotland, but across the UK in terms of promoting the women's game. What I would hope, of course, is that, you know, all of Scotland are going to watch the game tomorrow night. I believe it's on the BBC in Scotland. I would hope lots of football fans are getting behind it, because we all love a giant killing. And I can tell you that this would certainly be a pretty big giant killing if they managed to beat Wolfsburg. I mean, only a few years ago, Glasgow had to play one of their actual league games, which was going towards them winning the title that year, on a public park, because they couldn't get any other facilities in order to play the game. So, I mean, it's an amazing story. And as Gregor said, it's a triumph of the human spirit and determination to make things happen. And I wish them all the very best. It's superb.
Oh, we all do. We all certainly do. And it will be actually Scott Booth who will be in charge of Glasgow City against Wolfsburg. As a retired footballer, Booth was part of a BBC commentary team on men's football and was asked if he would co-commentate on the Women's Champions League in 2014-15, the last time that Glasgow made the quarter-final stage against Paris Saint-Germain. He felt as though he was asked almost apologetically, as though it would be demeaning to commentate on women's football. He enjoyed the experience despite Glasgow's 7-0 aggregate loss, and 3 months later the Glasgow job became available. Now, Booth had managed previously Stenhouse Muir, a semi-professional men's team, in 2014, and found that balancing work and football takes the ambition away. But he was immediately surprised at the application of the Glasgow players, although that in itself posed selection difficulties. He said, "I was really surprised by how committed the players were, how they were working or were at university and still give up 4 nights a week plus a Sunday to play. Increased investment by Celtic and Rangers has meant the gap is closing domestically from their rivals," and Booth concedes he is 100% aware of the difficulties that are likely to arise in the future as the need for infrastructure and financial support only increases. Against Wolfsburg, Glasgow City will be hoping for a footballing miracle. Perhaps they might find the kind of mindset Montgomery had of 22 years ago, that of a determined teenager, as Tom was telling us, desperate to change the face of Scottish women's football. So should Glasgow City do it, there is no doubt it would be one of football's all-time great giant-killing moments. And that kind of got us thinking about, well, those kind of amazing moments that we have enjoyed over the years, those kind of upsets and giant-killing moments. So, Tom, let's come to you. What's your standout moment?
I thought a lot about this, and I cannot think of one that would be anywhere near as good as Glasgow winning.
But, no, it's impossible.
Honestly, when you, I cannot encourage you enough to go and look into the story of Glasgow City before tomorrow night and really tune in, because it would be incredible if they pulled this off. But having said that, there are two that spring to mind, and I'm going to resist the temptation to mention a team that normally play in red and white and had a great run in the FA Cup a few years ago and went in non-league.
You just failed in that, that resist.
I haven't mentioned them by
name. I can't remember Brentford doing that well, but anyway.
No one knows who I'm talking about. Lincoln beat Burnley 1-0. But the two I've chosen are Wigan beating Manchester City in the FA Cup final in 2013. This is me being a little bit soft because of obviously how difficult Wigan have had things lately. And obviously that season they were relegated from the Premier League, but that was such a glorious moment. You know, that one afternoon, Ben Watson heading in that late winner. I think it was just, I can't think of many fans, apart from anyone who had a bet on Man City, or City fans themselves, who weren't absolutely delighted to see Wigan win. And the other one that always springs to mind for me was when the 2002 World Cup, the 98 World Cup was the first one for me, that's the first World Cup I really remember watching every single game. So when the next one came around, I was so excited. I remember trying, you know, looking at the fixtures, and I remember sitting down to watch, it must have been the daft hours or something like that, but Senegal to play France. And you know, in my head, France were this great team. They'd won Euro 2000, they'd been brilliant at the 98 World Cup, of course, and you know, this team of brilliant players and this, you know, people I'd never heard of, who then became to be household names: El Hadj Diouf, Papa Bouba Diop, and they were full value for the win against France as well. That was what was great about it. I think sometimes in these giant killing moments, someone scores from a corner and then they're desperately hanging on for 70 minutes. I remember watching that game and thinking how brilliant Senegal were, and that was what was so great about it. It then became, you know, they were one of the great stories of that World Cup. They went on to reach the quarterfinals, and obviously France were dumped out at the group stage. So that's one that always sticks in my memory as such a joyous giant killing, rather than one that was kind of fraught in nerves and things like that. It was a brilliant watch, that one.
I mean, it was, when you think back to that game, because I think it was the first game of that Group A, I think it was, that you're referring to as well.
I
and
think
so
it might have been, yeah.
And so when you're kicking off a campaign and fully expecting France to win, and it all goes badly for them, but all goes so well for Senegal. And I think France didn't win a single game.
They were awful.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can see how that one stands out for you as well. Although you rightly pointed out Wigan. I mean, that was a tremendous, tremendous FA Cup final for them. Yep. So, Gregor, where do you stand on your best moment?
I mean, one that stands out for me, and it's not for joyous reasons, it's the opposite, and it involves Celtic. was when they played Inverness Caledonian Thistle in the Scottish Cup.
Ah.
20 years ago now, and it prompted probably the best
headline. Yes. Go on.
Super Cali, go ballistic, Celtic are atrocious.
Yes.
And it cost John Barnes his job. He was the Celtic manager at the time. He'd come promising sexy football and played 4-2-2-2 like Brazil, and it was a disaster from start to finish. And I just remember it was a horrible night. And but you know, for Cali, that was kind of the moment they arrived in Scottish football. I think a few years later they were promoted to the top flight. You know, it's really kind of a team in the Highlands playing, you know, really, really small team defeating the mighty Celtic in the Scottish Cup. It's unheard of. Those things don't really happen in Scottish football. And it was thoroughly deserved. They won 3-1. And yes, that headline, you know, will make it go down in Scottish football in history. So that's probably the biggest shock I can remember, although I wasn't happy about it at the time.
Gregor, is there any you've ever been involved in on the pitch, or any
yes.
moments you can remember that might help give some advice to Glasgow City for tomorrow night?
What playing in? I'm not sure I've had any big...
I'm not trying to make a dig that you never made it to the Champions League. No. I just mean as to whether you've ever come up against a team far stronger than you and you managed to pull off a surprising result, should we say.
Do you know, honestly, every year we talk about the cup competitions come round, and you know, you or another editor go, any shocks? And I think my cup competition history in football was really shocking. We played Spurs once when I was at Forest and took them to a replay. That was about the best I did in a cup competition. I was on the end of a pretty bad shock when I played for, I say it's a shock, but when I played for Chesterfield, we played a team called Droylsden, who were two or three leagues below us. And we played them three or four times. It was like, the first one was called off by fog, because of fog. It was abandoned at half-time. The second one, we were winning, and the floodlights mysteriously went out on 70 minutes.
Ooh,
and their chairman and manager was a bit of a character as well, so there were some questions about that. And then we had to go back a third time for the replay, and we lost. And then the next morning, we woke up to find that the guy who'd scored both goals, and I think he played for Lincoln eventually, Newton, the left-back, Tom?
No, yeah, he wasn't ineligible.
Newton. Yes, he was ineligible.
No!
So we went through, yeah. It was the biggest kind of odyssey of cup football that I've ever been involved in. But it was a shock, almost, on the cards there.
Almost a shock.
But actually, when you go back to that game itself, they win. They must be going balmy because it's an amazing victory for them. How are you feeling to actually be the victim of a giant killing in relative terms?
Yeah, it's hugely embarrassing. You just want to get off the pitch and out the stadium as quick as possible. I mean, I've been on the end of a few defeats in cup competitions that are pretty embarrassing. So, you know, it will be some. The fact that it's a one-off game too for Wolfsburg, it's kind of, I don't know. You could see that possibly being, you know, a game where if they can defend well, if Glasgow can defend well and nick a goal, it could be very nervous. So, you know, the fact that they've only got 90 minutes to get beyond Glasgow Wolfsburg, then it's going to be a tricky one for them.
Well, it certainly will, and we do wish Glasgow City all the very best then for that tie. And that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Tom. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism on every platform. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.